Welcome to the Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for listening this week. Governor Rick Scott just finished announcing a sweeping series of proposals over guns, school safety, and mental health in the state of Florida. The package includes raising the legal age to buy any gun to 21, banning someone who has a court-ordered protection injunction against them from owning or having guns, and the ban on the sale of bump stocks. Those are among the proposals and just the latest developments in this week after the Stoneman Douglas school shooting left 17 dead and 15 hurt. The sheriff deputy on campus on duty at Stoneman Douglas on Valentine's Day headed to the shooting, rushed to the building where Nicholas Cruz had opened fire, but the deputy did not enter Building 12. Instead, he waited, and now he has retired from the force. It's just some of the developments that are happening here in the last few days into the Stoneman Douglas school shooting. More of the victims were laid to rest this week as well. And as the funerals continue, the confessed killer was in court earlier this week, and teachers return to campus with students returning next week. WLRN's Kate Stein is with us outside Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School in Parkland. Kate, the superintendent of Broward County Public Schools, Robert Runcie, just spoke with the media. What did he have to say?
So we heard from Superintendent Runcie about several different things. First of all, the teachers are back in school today for sort of a reunion and a time to reconvene and sort of talk through what they're going to be doing in the weeks ahead. So he was there talking about that. They had a breakfast together and therapy dogs, mental health resources available. But then the conversation turned to some of what you just talked about as far as Deputy Scott Peterson, who is the deputy, the school resource officer who didn't enter the school. The superintendent said we don't know why that is yet, but he was pretty harsh in his criticism of deputy for not entering the school. He called it inexcusable. We also heard from Anna Fusco, who is the head of the Broward Teachers Union, mm-hmm. on the issue with the deputy, and she was a little bit more moderate in her remarks about his decision to not enter the school. She said that, we don't know why, and we also, maybe there's a need for better training. And both she and Runcie were pretty adamant that they're excited that Scott has announced these different measures, but they think it's, it's an encouraging step in the right direction, but they think there still needs to be more done as far as resources and security at the Broward County Public Schools.
We know that late yesterday, the superintendent in the school district announced it was delaying the return to school for students at Stoneman Douglas by one day, supposed to be coming back for a half a day on Wednesday. Why the delay in that reopening for students?
So we didn't hear too much about that. I think that the more important thing to focus on, the superintendent said, was, making sure that students feel like they're supported. There are still funerals going on, and he said that, in the midst of those and hearing that some students and teachers might not be comfortable returning to the school, given everything that's happened here, the district just really wants to make sure that it has the resources in place to support the community.
WLRN's Kate Stein with us outside Marjorie Stoneman Douglas, just speaking with the Broward County Public School District Superintendent Robert Runcie. Kate, thanks for your time today on the Roundup. Appreciate it.
Thanks, Tom.
Latest on the investigation and the prosecution of Nicholas Cruz. Your phone calls as well, 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. You can find us on Twitter, at WLRN is our handle there. David Ovalle, covering crime in the courts for our partner, the Miami Herald, is back with us on the Roundup. David, thanks for your time today. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Willard Shepard, along with us as well, reporter for NBC6. He's from their studios with us in Broward County. Willard, great to have you back on the Roundup, too.
Okay, thanks for having me with you.
So let's talk here, David, about what we know and the latest in the investigation, with the latest news that came out late yesterday, of course, about the actions of this sheriff's deputy, who was the school resource officer, not engaging inside the building with Nicholas Cruz, despite the fact that he was there on the other side of the building, just outside at the same time. What do we know about protocol in this regard?
Well, generally, police officers, since the Columbine, the infamous Columbine shooting in the late 90s, when there was a lot of criticism about the delays of officers to go inside and confront these shooters, officers have generally been trained to go inside and actively seek out the threat and try to neutralize the threat as soon as possible, whether it's one sole police officer or a group of patrolmen that show up. So that is why it is outrageous for people because this training has been in place for a long time. Yeah. Now, we don't know if this particular officer has been trained to do that and what was going through his head, of course. But, you know, you never know what people are thinking at the time. And, you know, it appears maybe he just froze. And I think there's going to be a lot of hand-wringing from the department, but also I imagine from the officer himself.
I think, Willard, that the Broward County Sheriff, Scott Israel, described himself as sick in the stomach as he was delivering this news late on Thursday. And despite the deputy's retirement from his position at the sheriff's office, the investigation into his actions will continue, won't it?
Oh, yeah, very much so. And also, just some of the documents we were going over today, preparing our broadcast for this evening, deal with this school resource officer having some conversations and other information that was given to him well prior to the tragedy last week about Mr. Cruz. We're now finding out in some documents released to us a short time ago that the there was an out-of-state caller. You kept hearing the sheriff talking about, there was someone from out-of-state that called. Well, apparently that information was directed to the school resource officer, and one of the things that the sheriff's department has been looking at is, what did he do with this information when he had these kinds of warnings? It's listed here that there was pretty significant warning that came in this out-of-state call to the Broward Sheriff's Office. And as to his actions, I just heard the superintendent, Dr. Runcie, saying that, you know, at the time that these kids needed this officer the most, this deputy, that he didn't respond in the fashion that they certainly wanted to. I always caution people when I draw back on my military experience at times when under those kinds of situations, although be it differently in an airplane, that when that moment comes, an individual doesn't know exactly how they will respond. As David talked about, this individual just could have frozen there. Also, at that point, they didn't know how many shooters were in the building. Sure. There wasn't a lot of information. So it's going to take some more time to find out exactly what his actions were.
I think in the...
David, there we go.
Oh, in the outrage of the deputy's actions the day of the shooting, I think sort of overshadowed some of the documents that Willard is talking about. BSO released a timeline of a lot of their interactions with Cruz and his family in the years leading up to the shooting, and a couple of them stand out. For example, in February of 2016, someone reported that Cruz was planning to shoot up the school and showed a deputy an Instagram photo of a young person with guns. It wasn't clear which school was potentially targeted, but for whatever reason, that tip about Cruz was not forwarded to some investigative unit or to some detective, but instead to Peterson, the school resource officer, and nothing ever came of it. So that's just one example of a red flag that was raised early on, and now Internal Affairs is trying to figure out exactly what came of it.
And it's not just now former retired Deputy Peterson who is kind of under scrutiny here, Willard. I believe there were two other sheriff's deputies at BSO that the sheriff, Scott Israel, said they're looking at for their actions or inactions, as the case may be in this regard.
Yeah, that's correct. But those don't involve the tragedy at the school at that moment.
That's right. It doesn't involve the Valentine's Day massacre. Yes. Instead, it was engagements that Cruz or people around him may have had with law enforcement.
Correct. And in these documents that David was just referring to specifically in the timeline there, it's very clear that the Sheriff's Department was not happy and initiated an internal affairs investigation concerning two of these specific incidences where there were calls that were responded to by deputies many times to the Cruz residence where he was staying, and things that the mother told them at the time about him and his anger issues. Some of it shows that he got upset because she took his Xbox away from him and threw her against a wall. When the deputy got there, he was locked inside a room, didn't want to come out at first to speak to the deputy. So that's what they're looking into concerning those two deputies as to how did they take in this information? What did they do with it? And was it appropriately forwarded to the individuals who could, in essence, do more about it?
You know, the FBI has been under a lot of scrutiny after they came out with this sort of astonishing admission that they failed to follow up on a report in January. But there was an equally as troubling report on November 30th, according to Broward, where an unidentified caller from Massachusetts mm-hmm. called, and the quote from the report that was released is that Cruz will kill himself one day and believes he could be a school shooter in the making. And that's another one of these really jarring reports, because nothing ever came of it.
This was the call, Willard, that you referred to as the out-of-state call.
Correct.
And it's noteworthy, David, when you say November, you mean November of 2017. This is just a matter of 3 or 4 months ago. Some previous November calls that Willard, you referred to, was November of 2016. So there's this now long history here that we've seen for local law enforcement. We've seen with federal law enforcement, with the FBI's remarkable confession just a week ago, David, as you referred to, about these red flags in multiple locations, in social media, with state agencies, and with law enforcement, that now, of course, seem clear. And questions, Willard, that are being asked is, what is the procedure? And perhaps most importantly, what procedures may have not been followed by different agencies in this regard to engage with Cruz in real time?
Yeah, and I'm looking at one of these documents right now that there was, after his mother died, roughly November of 2017, and a family member called after her death and said that, Mr. Cruz has these rifles and she thinks that BSO should go recover them because she was aware of the trauma that he was dealing with after his mother died. And that's when he went to live with the other family that was with a friend of his in another part of North Broward County. But all of this certainly needs to be, and these policies and procedures need to be investigated. But in any of these situations that officers are responding to about domestic violence, when you have a couple that may be in an argument, though or a family situation like this, these are really very difficult things for police officers to be able to define as to what action should they take, because it's basically a judgment call. Mm-hmm. It's not like, we're driving on I-95 or the Palmetto or the Turnpike and you're driving 90 miles an hour. Well, that's not even close to what the speed limit is. It's a clear-cut violation of, a statute that an officer can execute.
Sure.
But in these situations, and this is a difficult call for them, they're in essence being asked to make a subjective judgment about what's going on.
And we'll get to your phone calls here in a moment. Willard Shepherd with NBC6 is along with us. David Ovalle with our partner, the Miami Herald, as well. Willard, any one of those, certainly, and all of them, are individual judgment calls by law enforcement officer who's engaged with that particular individual at that time. But David, because of the tragedy, we're looking at the volume of interaction and all of the different agencies that had some kind of connection and, frankly, different types of warnings, and the ability of these agencies to assess the totality of those threats in real time is also kind of a big comprehensive challenge, and one that is going to be focused on as law enforcement, as state agencies, regulators of all different types and stripes will look at what kind of reforms can be made.
Right. It wasn't just law enforcement that dropped the ball here. There was, he had multiple visits and with different mental health clinics. Mm-hmm. And it was determined a couple times that he didn't meet the criteria for an involuntary psychiatric evaluation under the state's Baker Act. So, there was neighbors who, when he was younger, didn't want to prosecute, didn't want to press charges when he, was shooting animals or getting into fights. And so there's a lot of sort of little things that kind of led up to the bigger and bigger things. And not just, even with the Department of Children and Families, yeah, they also investigated him at some point. So it's just a long laundry list of failures.
Systemic failures here. Linda is in Coconut Creek. Linda, thanks for holding on. You're on the radio. Go ahead.
Yes. Thank you. Thank you for taking my call. My concern is this, and I'm listening to everything you say. How many more Nicholas Cruzes are out there? How many more times will we have warning signals where nothing is done about it? Where is it going to start and end? What can they do from this horrific tragedy that happened to be more aware? I mean, how many times does law enforcement have to be notified before they, I mean, I know it's like you said, not going on 95 at a 990 miles an hour, but how do they compile? Can they come up with some sort of a database where they can keep a list of things like this so that this doesn't happen again? And I don't think we can point the finger, like they said, at just one person or one agency. It was a magnitude of failures from everywhere, from the FBI to BSO, the school resource officer. I mean, it just trickles down. There were so, and how did he get on the school grounds that day? Nobody has ever said that. How did that happen? Where was the failure there?
Linda, well, we appreciate your thoughts here. Willard, go ahead.
Yeah, as to her point on the school grounds, I've done a lot of looking into what has transpired here concerning that, and I'm sure David has as well. And the timeline that the sheriff has issued was that he got out of an Uber at 2:19, and roughly 2.5 minutes later, the shooting started in that freshman building.
Right.
Well, Dr. Runcie and the school board have stated that the school does not let out. The classes don't end, and the students have confirmed the classes do not end until 2:40. So by that timeline, all of the gates should have been locked and closed, and there's only one way in and out of the school, and that's on the east side of the property through the office. Well, the students that I've spoken with, they said, you know what, at first they thought he jumped over the fence because they said he could not have gone through the office. The security is very good at that school, top notch. And if he walked in the office door, he would have never been able to get by them because he's not a student there. He's not on a visitor's pass or anything like that. We're now coming to find out, and I don't know if David's been able to get to the bottom of it more than I have, that some of these gates are opened prior to the actual time that the last bell rings so that they can expedite getting the students out. Sure. You know, there's a lot of traffic.
Well, you've got 3,000 students leaving at the same time. You can't open the gates one by one right when the school bell rings and expect that to happen. But David Ovalle with the Herald, I want you to respond to Linda's concern about how many other Nicholas Cruzes are there.
That's a great question. And in fact, if you go on to MiamiHerald.com, I just posted a story about schools police arresting a student at Crop High School after he was
to North Dade County,
North Miami-Dade County, who was posting photos of himself with guns, almost taunting police. And his father actually said after the Parkland shooting that he was concerned about his son's photos with guns, and so he turned over the phones to the police department. So there, you've seen a response to Parkland by a lot of different arrests on online threats of students, sort of copycat or just posting things on the internet, and they're being more aggressive now, and maybe it'll kind of wane down, but I think you're definitely going to see a heightened scrutiny of people's online posts. Because you know, this young man, Nicholas Cruz, was out there doing similar things for at least, you know, a year or two, and everyone just kind of brushed it off.
And I think there was a similar type of incident in the Middle Keys against one of the Monroe County public high schools, some social media posts that were threatening, and individual in the Lower Keys wound up being arrested and investigated because of that. David Ovalle covering crimes in courts. Willard Shepherd watching much the same for NBC6. To both of you, thanks for your time and sharing your reporting with us here on the Florida Roundup.
Tom, thanks for having me.
Thank you.
Still to come, more warning signs that were missed. What records from school and other agencies show us about what confessed Stoneman Douglas gunman Nicholas Cruz was up to? That's next, and your phone calls at 800-743-9576. Welcome back to the Florida Roundup here on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. As always, thanks for listening. Nicholas Cruz was never expelled from public school. He was transferred 6 times in 3 years as school personnel tried to deal with disruptive behavior. Callers to law enforcement agencies warned at least 4 times over the past 2 years about his threatening behavior and access to guns. We're all learning more about his troubled past and the warning signs missed or ignored. We're also hearing how Governor Rick Scott and some leading Florida lawmakers are responding. Today, the governor announcing requiring crisis intervention training for all school personnel, funding for dedicated mental health counselors to provide direct counseling services to students at every school, and increasing state funding to schools to buy metal detectors, bulletproof glass, steel doors, and new locks. All of this, and the Broward Sheriff's Office ordered that deputies assigned to schools will now be able to carry rifles. This is Stoneman Douglas Senior Ryan Deitch speaking with us on Monday before that announcement.
I, for one, do not feel safe when I see armed officials having to be in a location, especially if it's still an active crime scene. Why would you want the student body to have to walk around that?
In other parts of Florida, school leaders are calling for heightened security, like bulletproof glass and mechanisms to automatically lock classroom doors, as well as social media monitoring to spot potentially troubled students before they become violent. Do you think these are the kinds of changes needed to make schools safer? You can join our conversation on Twitter at WLRN. Of course, call in as well, 800-743-9576. And our engagement editor, Katie Lepre, has been listening to folks sending us some text and their thoughts. Katie, what are you hearing?
Hi, Tom. Thank you. So Maria from the Rhodes texted us this morning and she said, all these security measures may be saving lives, but in the long run, what is needed in the first place is an assault rifle ban, which is crucial for our kids' future. Ted G in Coral Springs said, I don't think there's anything that can be done that will completely prevent all school shootings. And one more for you. Mm-hmm. Bianca from Tampa texted in and said, I don't know how a deputy being armed with an AR-15 would be a better defense than a handgun.
Deputies with long guns at schools, more bulletproof glass, spending on hardening schools, spending on mental health counseling. And what about the missed signs and the intersection of all the social service agencies and law enforcement that have been involved in this investigation? What have we learned since? 800-743-WLRN. Carol Marvin Miller is with us from our partner, the Miami Herald. Jessica Bakeman covers education for us here at WLRN. Carol, let me begin with you. You have done a tremendous amount of reporting over the course of many, many years on the kind of intersection of children, families, and the court system. What have you learned about the records you've been able to see from the Department of Children and Families in regards to its interaction with Nicholas Cruz and his family?
In 2016, DCF received what's called an Adult Protective Services complaint that Nicholas was being neglected by his mother. That was investigated, and DCF concluded that there was no abuse or neglect on the part of his mom, Linda Cruz. But in the course of conducting that investigation, DCF learned that there were troubling signs with Nicholas Cruz. There were allegations that he had been cutting himself, which is a very strong sign of the potential for mental illness. There were allegations that he wanted to go buy a gun. This was a case that I thought probably could have been better investigated. The counselor who I think had phoned the hotline never returned calls from DCF. The school resource officer refused to speak with the investigator. And so at a moment in time where they had an opportunity to intervene, there was no intervention.
You have reported on the systemic failures of this system for a good long time, Carol. How much of this rings familiar to you? How much of it is something you haven't necessarily seen before?
What I think is remarkable about Nicholas Cruz's case is that there were opportunities involving a multitude of public agencies. And in virtually, if not every single case, the opportunities were lost. The FBI received a tip that Nicholas wanted to be a school shooter. They dropped the ball. The sheriff's office had numerous encounters with Nicholas Cruz and his family, and they did nothing. DCF had one opportunity that I think you could argue was squandered. The school system had multiple opportunities to intervene and did not. And that is what I think is so remarkable about this case, is that had any one of those institutions intervened, taken the opportunity that was afforded them, and done something, we might not be sitting here today talking about it.
800-743-9576 is the telephone number. Get to your phone calls in a moment. Jessica Bakeman, I want to turn to you. Carol mentioned the opportunities that the school district has had in hindsight here. The governor announcing a number of different proposals today, some of them regarding the ownership of guns, some of them regarding a new state investment in mental health and mental health treatment, but also a significant number of proposals regarding and directed toward the public education infrastructure, both in terms of the buildings themselves, but also the mental health kind of personnel infrastructure. What strikes you about what the governor has been talking about today?
Well, we obviously have 2 weeks left in the legislative session. The governor made his announcement this morning. Legislative leaders are making theirs as we speak.
Yeah.
From what I understand, the differences so far that stick out in those plans, the governor is pushing to ban the purchase of firearms for anyone under the age of 21, with a few exceptions, mainly military, law enforcement. And the legislature is not interested in that so far, but I guess they want a waiting period on buying guns, which the governor is not supportive of. So those are a couple of the things that they're probably going to be trying to work out over the next couple of weeks. Seeing that the preliminary plans, and obviously, you know, we'll see what the actual language looks like going forward, and as they say, cliche, but the devil's in the details. Mm-hmm. But seeing where they're standing right now, and from my coverage of Tallahassee in the past, I feel like I've seen them a lot farther apart in with less time to get something done, and they're able to come to a compromise. So it seems like they're focused on making this happen.
Separate from the gun restrictions that the governor's talking about, and separate from the general investment that he's now interested in mental health, specifically as it relates to schools, Jessica, and then Carol, I'd like your thoughts as well. The governor's talking about establishing funding to require access to dedicated mental health counselors to provide direct counseling services to students at every school. How big of a departure is that from what we have today?
I would think that that varies really widely from school to school. And I mean, that's true about any kind of resource.
Sure.
And it varies widely from district to district, you know. I think that the governor saying, you know, he wants to put $500 million into mental health resources, and that if we have to forego tax cuts in order to get it there, so be it, he said, which is a big deal coming from him as he's focused so much on tax cuts. But obviously, we know that he is considering running for U.S. Senate, and so he might be trying to make that kind of statewide appeal.
Carol, what do you make of some of this focus on mental health, broadly speaking, from the governor, but also as it relates to the engagement with schools?
Florida is at or near the very bottom among states for investment in mental health services. That has always been so. And it in Florida, it takes a crisis invariably before the legislature, before leaders will act when it comes to social welfare programs. This is no exception. The program that would be most accessible for children when it comes to mental health services would be Medicaid. And Medicaid's dollars for mental health care always have been a huge challenge for low-income children. For children whose parents have private insurance, mental health care is seldom on the plan, and generally the services that you're going to get are restricted and short in duration. My opinion on this is, why do we always wait until something tragic, something horrible happens before we invest in the needs of our children and our most vulnerable?
That's one of my big questions is, okay, even if this influx of money happens, is it going to be recurring? You know, I mean, can our leaders say that this need didn't exist before this shooting?
And will it exist next budget cycle and the cycle after that? And how will it be impacted when, not if, but when the state economy turns and budget revenues turn out to be softer than anticipated, for instance?
Interestingly, I just got an email that the Florida Education Association supports the governor's proposal, which is interesting, of course.
Strange
because,
bedfellows.
Yeah, the sure. union doesn't typically support things that the governor wants to do. Obviously, he's a Republican, but I was kind of surprised by some of the governor's proposals as well, and it seems like he's really taking the issue seriously and trying to craft a comprehensive response.
I believe I'll share with the audience what you sent within the newsroom. It was among the strongest comments that you've ever seen as a reporter covering Governor Scott, and the most specific type of proposals that you've seen in the quickest amount of time coming from his administration.
Yeah, you know, the governor is exceptional at staying on message, and as an education reporter and someone who kind of lives in the weeds, the times that I've asked him questions that were about specific policies, he has usually avoided answering those specific questions and rather stayed to broad messaging yeah. about his school policy in general, which tends to be kids need to get a good education so they can get a job. Yeah. But in this case, he laid out a very specific plan.
We've got a lot of phone calls we're going to get to. We also want to get to some of your texts. Our engagement editor, Katie Lepre, is still with us. What are you reading on the text line?
So actually, we got a message earlier this morning before Governor Scott announced his plan that actually spoke right to, you know, the point of laws and getting to preventing people under 21 from having guns. And Sharon in Delray Beach really supports this. She said, you know, having the gun age move, you know, the legal purchasing age be pushed up to 21 would be, quote, nice too. She also said that guns for schools is just a Band-Aid. We got, you know, a message from Tara in West Pembroke Pines who said these changes are just treating symptoms of greater issues from, you know, issues in education and mental health, addressing income disparities, the holes in DCF. We're proposing turning schools into prisons that dismiss at 3:45.
800-743-9576 to add your voice. Let's go to Vish in Broward County in Cooper City. Vish, thank you for holding on. Your thoughts here.
Yes, thank you for taking my call. My wife was in the second floor building on the day, and she closed the door and saved the kid's life. So I am deeply affected by this incident. One thing I noticed here is our politicians, somehow, do not look at the data all over the world. They only talk about all the issues around and not banning the weapons of mass shooting. Okay, that is number one issue in this, because everywhere in the world, we have the same problem of mental health. We have same problem of law enforcement missing. Actually, U.S. has much better system in following, and I don't see the mass shooting, okay? So we are not that unique that we have too many mental health people. It is the fundamental problem is we need to take action on assault weapon. All others are true. We need to work on mental health. We need to give poor people health care access, everything. We don't have money. No one puts money. One, and we cannot 100% solve the mental health problem. So we should not have easy access to mass murder weapons. Okay, these are murder weapons. That is what I wanted to express here.
Vish, we appreciate that. Our thanks to your wife, a Stoneman Douglas teacher, who took heroic action. And we certainly are thinking about her and all of our colleagues as the teachers go back to school and the students will join them in the next several days. Vish, thank you for sharing your perspective with us here on the Florida Roundup.
Thank you very much for allowing me to express my opinion.
Carol, what Vish talks about there, we saw really on display, I think, this week at the CNN town hall at BB&T with the father of a 14-year-old victim really confronting, asking very plain questions to Senator Marco Rubio about acknowledging that the gun played a role in this, that despite a kind of knee-jerk, very common cliche political response that we can get from some of these tragedies of investment in mental health, all of which is true, the father really putting it straight to the senator to acknowledge, and he did acknowledge that the gun played a role in this.
I think what is remarkable about the reaction to this tragedy is the role of the kids. And I suspect that our lawmakers and perhaps the governor, who is rumored to be running for the U.S. Senate, are concerned about the kids. They mobilized not just themselves, but many, many others. There were walkouts throughout Florida, even other states. Tallahassee was flooded at the old Capitol, and there was palpable anger. When the governor addressed that angle today, his proposals were very wide-ranging, but they included virtually everything except restrictions on assault rifles, which I think are what is what the children are seeking.
Yeah, I think he would point out he did propose raising the purchasing age for a firearm, including assault rifles and long guns, to 21, as well as then banning a complete ban on the purchase of bump stocks.
Well, that would not have had any effect on the young man who went into a nightclub in Orlando,
the Pulse shooting,
nightclub, and shot the place up for hours before police intervened. What's interesting to me is that the proposals that were outlined today by the governor fall into mostly two or three camps. He's looking at increased mental health care for minors. He's looking at what's called target hardening of the school, but he's not really talking about the one thing that the kids are seeking. And I'm, you know, from a sort of sociological and political junkie point of view, very interested in seeing where this goes.
Yeah, you mentioned the Pulse shooting, which brings up the topic of non-school mass shootings, of course. And Ashley has been holding on in West Palm Beach with that perspective. Ashley, thank you for your patience. You are on the radio now. Go ahead.
Thank you for taking my call. Yeah, I feel like a lot of people, when they're talking about amping up the security at schools, are forgetting that we don't just have mass school shootings. We also have mass shootings at, we had the one at the music festival in Las Vegas.
That's right.
We had the one in the movie theater. We had the one in the church where the white man went into the black church and opened fire on everybody. And they're using these assault weapons in order to mass murder people in a short amount of time. So, okay, we can amp up security, we can arm our teachers, but what if someone who is having these mental health issues is over the age of 21 and is able to purchase the gun, goes out and does a mass shooting somewhere else? I mean, we even have these issues in our malls. Boynton Beach Mall has an issue with shootings. So it's not just our schools that need security. We need to look into the overpopulation of guns. It's not the lack of guns that are the problem. It's not the lack of the security at school. It's more of the problem that we have an ease of access to these guns in Florida and our nation. And in Florida, it's just a little bit too easy to acquire a weapon that is for killing people. It's not to go to the shooting range. It's not for hunting. It was designed for war.
Ashley in West Palm Beach, thank you for that perspective. I think on the federal response here, among the places of focus, Jessica and Carol have been on this idea of background checks and tightening up some of the loopholes in the background checks. I mean, Ashley talks about the supply of guns out there. Certainly those on Capitol Hill or who are supportive of the Second Amendment and Second Amendment rights have focused to some degree, Carol, this idea of background checks. And had background checks been tightened, perhaps that could influence not only the Pulse shooting and how that shooter acquired the gun, but also in a Nicholas Cruz type incident.
The background screening system as it currently exists would not have caught Nicholas Cruz. Would not have caught Omar Mateen in Orlando. Both of these men had not been convicted of a crime, had not been involuntarily committed under the Baker Act. And unless we are going to go toward a much more thorough, sophisticated background screening system, it's not going to catch guys like this who have been flying under the radar for quite some time.
The governor today proposed what he's calling the Violent Threat Restraining Order. In the governor's words, it would allow a court to prohibit a violent or mentally ill person from purchasing or possessing a firearm or any other weapon when either a family member, community welfare expert, or law enforcement officer files a sworn request and presents evidence to the court of a threat of violence involving firearms or weapons. How big of a departure would that be from your understanding currently, Carol? Tough to try to analyze this right now, I understand. But so the governor's portion of his comments today were directed at some of these, not necessarily background checks per se, but tightening up the ability of essentially a restraining order against an individual, perhaps if it's a violent restraining order, could be the red flag to not allow them to legally acquire a firearm.
Well, the first thing that comes to mind to me is what we learned last night at the press conference by Sheriff Scott Israel, and that is that there were numerous red flags, big, enormous, shining red flags that all were ignored. And all of these sort of detection systems, they rely upon our law enforcement officers, social service agencies to do their jobs effectively and competently. And to the extent that all these opportunities for the Broward County Sheriff's Office were blown, we're still in the same place. You're not going to get a restraining order if you don't have adequate evidence that right. someone is a threat.
Right.
And that's where it's one of the places where we went wrong here, is that we did have systems in place and none of them worked.
Jessica?
I was going to go back to what Carol mentioned earlier, talking about the kids and seeing the remarkable response of the students. And obviously we've had them here in the studio and we've been talking to them. And, you know, we reported on how they're headed back to school next week. And obviously they're going to have a lot of trauma and grief to work through and to continue working through, as the whole community does. And, you know, I chatted informally with a few of them after the CNN town hall the other night. And, you know, one of them mentioned to me he's taking 5 AP classes this year and supposed to take the SAT next month. You know, they're kids. They have the same kind of pressures that high school students have, which are a lot. And I thought it was interesting to follow some of their social media feeds. Delaney Tarr, who we heard her speak at the rally, she had a comment about how her innocence and childhood had been robbed.
Right.
She tweeted yesterday, "Today, I, along with many others, took some time to step back and grieve. We have thrown ourselves into this as much as we can, but we still have tears to shed, still have sorrow to share. We are reminded just how much this is for those 17 and for every other student out there." She also said, "Last night I got the most sleep I've gotten in days. To all my peers, please take care of yourselves. We're still grieving. We need to take a break every once in a while."
Yeah, the anguish is palpable, no doubt. And as those student leaders have stepped forth, they have said they're speaking for those who are unable to because of the grief or don't want to at this point, but yet still support this idea of school safety, student safety, and the issue of gun control, putting it front and foremost on the agenda of the politicians statewide as well as nationally in a way that has never happened after a mass shooting.
They're taking on so much, and I think so many people around the country have been quick to say, they are the hope. They are going to make a difference. They're going to take up this fight that so many others have fought and failed at over time. And I just think that especially as a community here, when the national media moves on, when something else happens and everyone else is paying attention to something else, we need to remember that, like, we need to take care of the young people in this community who are being, you know, who are having a lot put on their shoulders. And granted, you know, they're stepping out in the spotlight and asking for it to some extent, but they also are kids and they may not know everything that they're, you know, getting themselves into.
It is an education interrupted. It's an education interrupted and torn by violence, never which to return to what it was on February 13th for this community, certainly in South Florida, and for those students, absolutely, and their families. We've got more to come on the Florida Roundup, including your phone calls, 800-743-9576. More after this. Back on the Florida Roundup here on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks again for listening. Carol Marvin Miller from our partner, the Miami Herald, is along with us. Our education reporter at WLRN, Jessica Bakeman, is with us, as is our engagement editor, Katie Lepre. Katie, I want to hear if folks are texting us about school safety particularly. I know that the Broward County Sheriff's Office this week, in response to the shooting, talked about that deputies will be allowed to carry rifles on public school property as they look to protect. The teachers are back at Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School today on this Friday. Students are expected to return for the first day for a half day on Wednesday. What are you reading from our texters?
So Willie H. in Oakland Park says he's torn about this. He says that schools do need increased security. The glass door, the glass and the doors are a good start, but he's torn on rifles. He understands where they're coming from, but feels that a handgun would be as effective when police are already in school. One other thing, talking about a recommendation that President Trump made, Bettina and Davey said that she does not want to see teachers equipped with a gun. She says she's a licensed mental health counselor with experience with acute psychiatric disorders, and says that, you know, the solution may really be in teachers having training on basic mental health principles to identify students who are isolating and have no friends and, you know, other such mm-hmm. signs. You know, one other thing that she pointed out was, you know, none of us are immune to having a mental illness or a bad day. She said that, you know, hold on, I'm just reading through these notes, that, you know, the frontal lobe in children functions as your consequence center, and it's not developed until we're 25. You know, right. Definitely not an 18-year-old has those capabilities.
Yeah, that physiology has been part of the argument by the student leaders at Stoneman Douglas. They've been requesting raising the purchase for handguns and rifles, certainly assault rifles, to 25, and even far beyond what even the governor has mentioned today, which is up to 21. I want to squeeze in a quick phone call here from Brian in Fort Lauderdale, who's been holding on. Some thoughts, Brian, on arming teachers in the classroom. Go ahead. You're on the radio.
Yeah, I just don't see how it could be beneficial giving these teachers guns. I mean, they're not trained personnel. They're teachers. I mean, I guess people have this idea that for some reason they could be the first line of defense. But my fear is that the teachers could even use the weapon against the students. I mean, there were cases, even I believe in like Fort Hood, where an ex-soldier went up and shot up a base.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I mean, there's nothing really to stop a teacher from doing the same thing. And I would like to add, and perhaps it's just a cynic in me, but I feel as if after Sandy Hook and these kids as young as 10 years old were killed, not much was done. So I think maybe now will be different. However, I just don't feel, you know, much of anything will come of this.
Brian, we appreciate your thoughts there from Fort Lauderdale, worried about teachers using guns in school if they're allowed to be armed. And it's part of the concern we've heard from law enforcement as well, as in these active shooter incidents, if teachers have firearms as well, the difficulty that SWAT teams and other first responders may have in figuring out who has weapons. In fact, Jessica, I think one of the stories we heard out of one of the classrooms where the tragedy occurred was, as the SWAT team came in, the first question was to the students and teachers gathered there, is anybody injured? The second question was, does anybody have a gun? Let's talk quickly here in our final moments, Jessica, about some of the funding proposals the governor's talked about in terms of hardening schools. We talked about, you know, the sheriff's deputies using long rifles, having long rifles on school. The governor wants to spend more money on bulletproof glass, automatic locks, and those kinds of things. Where would it come from, and what would be the impact on education funding?
Well, you know, Tom, I've sat here in this chair several times talking to you about what's called capital outlay funding. It's public funding that is used for the construction and maintenance of school facilities. With the controversial aspects that we've talked about before is how there have been proposals and now a law that requires school districts to share that money with privately run charter schools. And now the governor is saying he wants to say that all capital funding, whether it comes from the state or local taxpayer dollars, which is specifically levied by locally elected school boards, that all of that money should go towards quote-unquote hardening the schools, right, before being used for any other purposes.
Yeah.
And that's getting a lot more attention than I thought maybe it would, given that it's within the context of this much broader plan that has probably much more controversial aspects to it. But, you know, I mean, Florida is a high-growth state. There are tens of thousands more students coming into the public school system every year. And so districts in metropolitan areas like Miami, Fort Lauderdale, Orlando, Jacksonville, they are building schools all the time. They're trying to repair their aging schools all the time. And so this would put that on the back burner.
And Carol, just finally, this idea of balancing mental health investment and school hardening investment. You've covered a lot of these types of debates in the past. What should we look forward to? What are some of the voices that we need to hear from in this?
Well, I want to continue to hear from the students. They are what in Tallahassee they like to refer to as the stakeholders, as are the teachers.
Yeah.
And I think one of the things that made this event so singular was that these kids were, in spite of what they had endured, they were articulate,
yeah.
they were civil, they were effective.
Yeah.
And we'd never really seen that before.
They are speech and debate kids. They are theater kids. They are journalism kids. That is what I'm hearing.
Jessica Bakeman with WLRN, Carol Marvin Miller from the Miami Herald, Katie Leprey from WLRN. Thanks to all three of you. And thanks to our callers as well. The Florida Roundup is produced by Bridget O'Brien. And our technical supervisor is Jason Zabka. Thanks for calling and thanks for listening.